Gulliver's Travels, Part 3, Chapter 8. A Further Account of Glubdubdrib, Ancient and Modern History Corrected. Having a desire to see those ancients who are most renowned for wit and learning, I set apart one day on purpose. I proposed that Homer and Aristotle might appear at the head of all their commentators, but they were so numerous that some hundreds were forced to attend in the court and outward rooms of the palace. I knew and could distinguish between those two heroes at first sight, not only from the crowd, but from each other. Homer was the taller and comelier person of the two, walked very erect for one of his age, and his eyes were in the most quick and piercing I ever beheld. Aristotle stooped much, and made use of a staff. His visage was meagre, his hair lank and thin, his voice hollow. I soon discovered that both of them were perfect strangers to the rest of the company, and had never been seen or heard of them before. I had heard a whisper from a ghost who shall be nameless, that these commentators always kept in the most distant quarters from their principals in the lower world, through a consciousness of shame and guilt, because they had so horribly misrepresented the meaning of those authors to posterity. I introduced Didymus and Eustathius to Homer, and prevailed on him to treat them better than perhaps they deserved, for he soon found they wanted a genius to enter the spirit of a poet. But Aristotle was all out of patience with the account I gave him of Scotus and Remus, and presented them to him, and he asked them whether the rest of the tribe were as great as dunces of themselves. I then desired the governor to call up Descartes and Gassendi, with whom I prevailed to explain their systems to Aristotle. This great philosopher freely acknowledged his own mistakes in natural philosophy, because he proceeded in many things upon conjecture, as all men must do, and he found that Gassendi, who had made the doctrine of Epicurus as palatable as he could, and the vortices of Descartes, who were equally to be exploded, he predicted the same fate to attraction, whereof the present learned are such zealous assertors, he said, that new systems of nature were but new fashions, which could vary in every age, and even those who pretend to demonstrate them from mathematical principles would flourish, but a short period of time would be out of vogue when that was determined. I spent 5 days in conversing with many others of the ancient learned. I saw most of the first Roman emperors. I prevailed on the governor to call up Heliogabalus's cooks to dress us dinner, but they could not show us much of their skill for want of materials. A helot of Agaslius made us a dish of Spartan broth, but I was not able to get down a second spoonful. The two gentlemen who conducted me to the island were pressed by their private affairs to return in 3 days, which I employed in seeing some of the modern dead, who had made the greatest figure for 200 or 300 years past, and in our own and other countries of Europe. And having been always a great admirer of old illustrious families, I desired the governor would call up a dozen or two of kings, with their ancestors in order for 8 or 9 generations. But my disappointment was grievous and unexpected, for, instead of a long train with royal diadems, I saw in one family 2 fiddlers, 3 spruce courtiers, an Italian prelate, another a barber, an abbot, and 2 cardinals. I have too great a veneration for crowned heads to dwell any longer on so nice a subject, but as to counts, marquises, dukes, earls, and the likes, I was not so scrupulous, and I confess it was not without some pleasure that I found myself able to trace the particular features by which certain families are distinguished up to their originals. I could plainly discover, once one family derives a long chin, why a second has abounded with knaves for 2 generations and fools for 2 more, why a third happened to be crack-brained and 4 happened to be sharpers. Once it came, when Polydor Virgil says of a certain grey house, Nec vir fortis, nec foemina casta, how cruelty, falsehood, and cowardice grew to be characteristics by which certain families are distinguished as much as their coat of arms. Who first brought the pox into a noble house which has lineally descended in scrofulous tumours into their posterity? Neither could I wonder at all this when I saw such an interruption of lineages by pages, lackeys, valets, coachmen, gamesters, fiddlers, players, captains, and pickpockets. I was chiefly disgusted with modern history, for having strictly examined all the persons of great in name and courts of princes for 100 years past, I found how the world had been misled by prostitute writers. To ascribe the greatest exploits in war to cowards, the wisest counsel to fools, sincerity to flatterers, Roman virtue to betrayers of their country, piety to atheists, chastity to sodomites, truth to informers, how many innocent and excellent persons had been condemned to death or banishment by the practicing of great ministers upon the corruption of judges and the malice of factions? How many villains had been exalted to the highest places of trust, power, dignity, and profit? How great a share in the motions and events of courts, councils, and senates might be challenged by bards, whores, pimps, parasites, and buffoons? How low an opinion I had of human wisdom and integrity, when I was truly informed of the springs and motives of great enterprises and revolutions in the world, and of the contemptible accidents to which they owed their success. Here I discovered the roguery and ignorance of those who pretend to write anecdotes or secret history, who send so many kings to their graves with a cup of poison, will repeat this discourse between a prince and chief minister where no witnesses was by, unlock the thoughts and cabinets of ambassadors and secretaries of state, and have the perpetual misfortune to be mistaken. Here I discovered the true cause of many great events that have surprised the world, how a whore can govern the back stairs a council, and the council a senate. A general confessed, in my presence, that he got a victory purely by the force of cowardice and ill conduct, and an admiral, for want of proper intelligence, he beat the enemy to whom he intended to betray the fleet. Three kings protested to me in their whole reigns they never did once prefer any person of merit unless by mistake or treachery of some minister in whom they had confided. Neither would they do it if they were alive again. And they showed, with great strength of reason, that the royal throne could not be supported without corruption, because that positive, confident, restive temper which virtue infused into a man was a perpetual clog to public business. I had the curiosity to inquire in a particular manner by what methods great numbers had produced themselves to high titles of honour and prodigious estates. And I confined my inquiry to a very modern period, however, without grating upon present times, because I would be sure to give no offence even to foreigners, for I hope the reader need not be told that I do not in the least intend my own country in what I say upon this occasion. A great number of persons concerned were called up, and upon a very slight examination discovered such a scene of infamy that I could not reflect upon it without some seriousness. Perjury, oppression, subordination, fraud, panderism, and the like infirmities were among the most excusable arts they had to mention, and for these I gave, as it was reasonable, great allowance. But when some confess they owe their greatness and wealth to sodomy or incest, others to the prostituting of their own wives and daughters, others to the betraying of their country or their prince, some to poisoning, more to the perverting of justice in order to destroy the innocent, I hope I may be pardoned if these discoveries inclined me a little to abate that profound veneration, from which I am naturally apt to pay to persons of high rank, who ought to be treated with the utmost respect due to their sublime dignity by us their inferiors. I have often read some great services done to princes and states, and desired to see the persons by whom those services were performed. Upon inquiry, I was told that their names were to be found on no record, except a few of them, whom history has represented as the vilest rogues and traitors. As to the rest, I never once heard of them. They all appeared with dejected looks, and in the meanest habit, most of them telling me they died in poverty and disgrace, and the rest on a scaffold or a gibbet. Among others, there was one person whose case appeared a little singular. Had a youth about 18 years old standing by his side, he told me he had for many years been a commander of a ship, and in the sea fight at Actium, and had the good fortune to break through the enemy's great line of battle, sink three of their capital ships, and take a fourth, which was the sole cause of Antony's flight and the victory that ensued. That the youth standing by him, his only son, was killed in the action. He added that upon the confidence of some merit in the war being at the end, he went to Rome and solicited the court of Augustus to be referred to a greater ship, whose commander had been killed, but without any regard to his pretensions, it was given to a boy who had never seen the sea, the son of Liburnia, who waited on one of the emperor's mistresses. Returning back to his own vessel, he was charged with neglect of duty, and the ship given to a favorite page of Poblocchio, the vice-admiral, whereupon he retired to a poor farm at a great distance from Rome, and there ended his life. I was curious to know the truth of this story, that I desired Agrippa might be called, who was the admiral in that fight. He appeared and confirmed the whole account, but with much more advantage to the captain, whose modesty had extenuated or concealed a great part of his merit. I was surprised to find corruption grown so high and so quick in that empire, by the force of luxury so lately introduced, which made me less wonder at many parallel cases in other countries, where vices of all kinds have reigned so much longer, and where the whole praise as well as pillage has been engrossed by the chief commander, who perhaps had the least title to either. As every person called up made exactly the same appearance he had done in the world, it gave me melancholy reflections to observe how much the race of humankind was degenerated among us with these 100 years past. How the pox, under all its consequences and denominations, had altered every lineament of English countenance, shortened the size of bodies, unbraced the nerves, relaxed the sinews and muscles, introduced a shallow complexion, and rendered the flesh loose and rancid. I descended so low as to desire some English yeoman of the old stamp might be summoned to appear, once so famous for the simplicity of their manners, diet and dress, for justice in their dealings, for the true spirit of liberty, for their valour and love of their country, Neither could I be wholly unmoved after comparing the living with the dead, when I considered how all these pure native virtues were prostituted for a piece of money by their grandchildren, who, in selling their votes and managing at elections, have acquired every vice and corruption that can be possibly learned in a court. End of chapter 8. Read by David Russell. For Lit2Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.